the show that's focused on building strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goal. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, hey, and we do have Professor Rick Plum with us. Here we go again. It is all about Bucket Strategy Investing. You're tuned into the one show that gives you the strategies you need. It's, of course, the one program that gives you the best in money information every single day right here. We're standing by, ready to talk with you. Now, this hour, we're going to get into the subject of tax brackets and why it's important to understand how they work. This came up in the most recent workshop, which we'll get details on that from Professor Plum. But think about it. You know, maybe you're in the 15% bracket, or you're in the 25% bracket, or maybe you're not sure where you are in your taxes. But the question might come up, what does it all mean? Do you really pay 25 cents in tax on every dollar you earn if you're in the 25% tax bracket? Now, we're talking about this because many people believe that it's true. As soon as you're in that tax bracket, a quarter of your income is always gone. Well, we're here to tell you that that's incorrect, okay? That's wrong. Marginal brackets, average brackets, why you need to know about them, that's coming up in just a moment or two right here on the show. You got a question for the Brain Trust? You give us a call right now. Our live on-air number is open, 877-PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Whatever questions you have regarding your money, taxes, strategy, retirement, insurance, annuities, Social Security, whatever it is, we're here to talk to you about it. We got lines open right now. You can just jump on into the discussion. Emails, you get those to us at wealthed.com. You click on the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page and send it to us here in the studio. Professor Plum, we welcome him back. He's our partially tenured but fully caffeinated financial advisor. Here again, courtesy of the wonderful people at Lucia Capital Group who bring you this hour of the show. If you need a bucket strategy put together specifically for you, you need to talk to an advisor. You want one that fits your goals, you can call the professor or anyone at Lucia Capital Group at this number, 800-644-1150. Preparing yourself for whatever might happen, hey, that's one of the keys to a successful retirement plan. You just need to make sure you have a plan for whatever might happen down the line. So again, the number at Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. On the air, 877-PLANNER. Welcome back.
Thank you. I was gone for a day, at least from Showtime.
I didn't think we'd miss you. I mean, you know, we had a lot of fun on Friday with Terry Keyes. He's all over the place, as you know, you might expect. But it's nice to have you back. You were in Las Vegas for the workshop last Saturday.
Right, giving a couple speeches on Friday as well.
Yeah. Kind of a busy guy. We're going to cover later on in the program some of the topics that people brought up at the workshop and some of the ones that perhaps they're likely to bring up coming up this weekend in Seattle.
Seattle, yes.
That's right. Pacific Northwest this weekend. But for the moment, I want to focus, Professor Plum, on the whole idea of tax brackets. We had a couple of calls on this last week. And the confusion about when you're in a certain bracket, am I paying 25 cents on every dollar that I earn if I'm in the 25% tax bracket? Because there are people who do believe that and wind up hurting themselves from both a financial, current financial standpoint and a planning standpoint.
And it is a complex, very convoluted in many respects, way to look at what you actually owe. How do you go about calculating it? What's going on with this? And unfortunately, the more they try to simplify the tax code, the worse it gets. And unfortunately, I'm going to try to explain a little bit about it, but this is why it's very difficult for a flat tax to actually be enacted. And part of it is because we have to decide what is income and what isn't income. And I've got a new to work on, I think that might
for
help.
For the show or for person or what do you got?
For anybody that wants to talk about taxes. So those people that are heavily medicated and constrained with white jackets, we're going to talk about taxes because they're the only people really want to know about taxes.
Because they're the ones who tried to figure out taxes
and they went
absolutely nuts.
Yes. Yeah. But the IRS rounds everything to the dollar. They don't deal with cents so much. So it's very easy to talk about in dollars. Let's just look at our income as a stack of $1 bills. We're going to stack every dollar we have in a pile, just stacked all the way up, every dollar we have. But what actually goes into that stack of income from the IRS standpoint? If I have a salary of $50,000, does all $50,000 go into that stack? Not necessarily. If I have a salary of $50,000, but I'm paying medical expenses or medical premiums out of that, that comes off the top before it goes into the tax return stack. So I'm going to look at my income is one thing, but how much goes into this stack of $1 bills for tax purposes.
And yeah,
there's certain things that come off the top. Your medical payments, your fringe benefits, your pre-tax items, your 401k, none of that makes it to the stack. That's all taken off the table before you start stacking up your dollar bills. But after that, now we've got all of our wages in there. Any interest, put them in the stack. Capital gains, dividends, all that kind of stuff. Passive income, everything that is a taxable potential gross income to us is put into that stack of $1 bills. So we've got this hopefully growing stack. Now, we're going to sort it out and put all the capital gains, long-term capital gains, and qualified dividends at the bottom of the stack. So those go in the first part of the stack. And then all the ordinary income stacks up on the top. So we've got this huge stack of income, huge stack of $1 bills. Got it? Is that okay? Can we get a visual?
I have it. Now this requires some very careful thinking on the part of people. And I want you to hold that thought for a little bit, if you would. Because I know where you're going with this, and it's going to require a little bit more time than we have. Not a lot, but a little bit more. So I want to take a couple of calls here before we get to the break, and then we'll continue on with your discussion of the stacks, because I know right where you're going with this. And if you can follow along, we're going to warn you, you got to follow along. It can be very, very helpful, okay? All right. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Let's move along to Richard, somewhere in Florida this hour. Hello, Richard.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, how are you?
Doing good. I had a question about non-traded REITs.
Yes, sir.
It's my understanding, or was my understanding, that they never fluctuate in valuation. Some that I purchased in the last few years, valuation on them. And I've also heard the government is going to be evaluating or causing them to use a different accounting method or something in
yes.
April. Can you give me an idea of why non-traded REITs would change value and what the impact of that is going to be? And if it is changing value, is that something to be concerned about?
Yes and no, it is. It's something to be aware of as much as anything else. And you should have been aware of it before you purchased it. But what happens is they don't fluctuate in price during what they call the offering period. When they're raising capital, they're selling shares of the company that's going out and buying real estate or doing things with the money. So they're selling it at a predetermined price, $10 a share, $20 a share, $25 a share. And while they're raising capital and deploying the capital, buying real estate and things of that nature, evaluating the cost. I mean, they could have bought a building, the offering period may be a couple years long. So they bought a building 3 years ago, 2 years ago. We're still in the offering period. They're still selling it at $10 a share. But that building that they bought back in 2013, maybe it's appreciated or maybe it's gone down. That isn't reflected in the ongoing offering price in many of the old, especially the older REITs. New REITs are doing things and they're revaluing them a little quicker. But at some point in the life cycle, they have to go through and reappraise the entire portfolio, divided by, and that will come up with a current, what they call net asset value. So that you've got all, especially, it used to be once they got done with the offering period, they had 18 months to revalue the properties or whatever the assets are to create an actual identifiable share price. Now, is that a real number? An appraisal is a guess at the price. Until you actually have somebody writing you a check buying it, it's not an exact price, but it's a good representation of what that real estate or what those underlying assets should be worth. Now, what is the problem, why the government got involved, is that people were buying it, telling them it was one price and it would always be worth that price, and that's, unfortunately, as we found out, not necessarily the case. Real estate goes up and down in value. So properties that were purchased in the 2005, 6, 7, 8 time horizon have gone down and may be recovering now. Properties purchased in the 10, 11, 12 time horizon have gone up and are worth more. So what is my true value of my investment? And what were the fees? And this is where it pays to know what's going on. There were fees and expenses in that $10 price. And the reality is when you bought a non-traded REIT at $10, obviously not all of it goes into the ground and buys a building. You've got expenses, selling expenses, all kinds of expenses of looking into and doing the due diligence buying a property. And so realistically, only about 88 cents on the dollar goes into the ground. So what's happening in April is that when you buy a non-traded REIT for $10, it is going to start showing up in your account day one at the net of fees net asset value, or the projected net of fees. So whatever, if the fees are 10% up front, it's going to show $9 a share in your account. And so all of these REITs are going to get repriced in April here pretty quick, and show a more true value for the underlying asset.
So whenever they do these reevaluations, will that be done every year? Or
Once they get into the revaluation area, then they're going to start revaluing as at least every year, so that they can keep you up to date on what's potentially happening, at least from an appraisal standpoint, in the properties.
Yeah, I tell you what, hey Richard, I'm sorry, hang on. I have to take a break here. If you can hang on a second, if you have some more questions, hold. We can give you a whole lot more information on this. That's something else that we haven't talked about for a little while.
Right.
But these are rules that are changing or have changed or going to be changing some more. So hold on, Richard, if you would. We've also got Sally in Mountain View, California. I know you got a Social Security question. And we still have two lines open, 877-PLANNER. Your money, whatever you have, you give us a call. Brain Trust will answer them. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum from Lucia Capital Group. We're coming back in. Is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. Got some folks on hold, so we're going to get right back to the calls. 877-PLANNER. If you're on hold, don't go away. That's a direct order from me, because we're going to get to everybody. We were talking before the break, just very quickly, with Richard somewhere in Florida with regard to a real estate investment trust. I want to make sure your question was answered, Richard, so I think you had at least one more. So just go right ahead. We'll come right back to you. What else do you have?
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to know if the values of these REITs do go down, or the valuation does go down, is that a cause for concern? And if it does go down, if the REIT ever went public, is that somewhere in there where it would probably go public at that price?
Having it go down in price, they will go down in price in April, the ones that are being carried at their offering price. There's no question about that, because every REIT out there has some upfront expenses. And so they are going to show at a lower price. Should it be something to be worried about? No, you should be aware of what those upfront prices were when you bought into it. Hopefully somebody can help you find those out. The larger the drop, I mean, it depends on how old the REIT is, how long it's been in existence, what they were buying, have they been doing a good job, and how much in upfront fees there were to begin with, whether you should or should not be worried about it. Now, they're going to go up and down. Does it affect the income? Generally, it doesn't affect the income on most of the REITs, because the rent is the rent. I mean, if I have a building that I'm renting out for, $50,000 a year, and somebody comes by and says the appraisal is a lot higher or a lot lower than I paid for it originally, that doesn't necessarily mean I can raise the rents or I have to reduce the rents. So the rents are going to, the income's going to remain fairly stable. It is something to understand. I'm not going to say you should be worried about it or that you have to, freak out about it, but it is something you need to understand.
Yeah, Richard, I tell you.
But that would be about a price where it would potentially go public at.
If you have some more questions, I have to get to a couple more calls, but please hang on, and Professor Plum will go over this with you in a lot more detail, because I know they can be difficult to understand. And with these rule changes, I mean, it's even, we don't even have necessarily every piece of information.
Yeah. But the price, unless it's currently being shown at net asset value, it will go down.
Exactly. So hold on, Richard. We'll be happy to talk to you a little bit more about this off the air. Sally is up next. Sally, thanks for hanging on in Mountain View, California. How can we help you today?
Yes. I heard you talk about Social Security, when to take the Social Security, and last week. So I do have this kind of question.
Okay.
I'm currently has some uncertain health condition, so I will put myself in a poor health this category. But I do not need additional money for living yet, and I'm not working now. And I just wonder, should I take Social Security now or wait till full retirement age of 66, or wait until 70? And then related to that, I just wondered, like my kind of person, I think I should not consider deferred annuity, right?
Well, let's go back to the Social Security. How old are you right now, Sally?
63.
And how much do you make? You said you were still working.
Not working.
Oh, not working. Okay. And you have poor health. Are you married or single?
Single.
Okay. And so you're not worried about leaving a survivor benefit from anybody. There's no kids or dependents that would get a benefit from you. With somebody that has poor health and is not worth, or considers poor health, doesn't expect a normal to a long time longevity, I would even consider taking it now, even though you don't necessarily need it. You will receive more money over your expected lifetime taking it now than waiting until 70, even though the benefit will be higher at 70. You're giving up 7 years worth of, albeit lower, you're giving up 7 years worth of income. And it does take quite a while. It takes 12 years or so after 70 to make up that early loss of income. So if you don't think you're going to make it to 82, 83, 84 years of age, you might as well take the Social Security now that you're not working. And that way you could either invest the money that you're receiving or not take as much money out of your investments. Or if you're if you've already got more pensions than you need, it gives you the ability to invest for heirs down the line.
I see. So related to that, you know, I heard a lot of good things about this deferred annuity. I should not consider that at all, right?
What deferred annuity?
You know, like you have to hold on to it for 10 years, then you can starting to take 5%. That means I have at least to live another 30 years
right.
Have the principal back.
Right. You're talking about a lifetime, either on an index chassis or a variable annuity chassis, where they guarantee a certain income for the rest of your life. One of the reasons to buy these types of products is you have longevity. If you don't have longevity, these are not the appropriate products for you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Okay?
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call.
So, if they're going to pay you 5%, let's say that she was 65 right now and she can, you know, get an income for 5%. That takes 20 years just to get her own money back. And there'll be a little bit of earnings, depending, again, on whether it's a variable annuity or an index annuity. But there'll be a little bit of earnings, but it's not a great earnings investment. It's a great peace of mind investment. But she could do the same thing, you know, with other assets that she doesn't have to get into one of these that costs money. And
okay,
so else.
Do the same thing how? What's a way that somebody can do that?
Well, she could use she could actually use bank accounts for this matter, and then because she doesn't need the guarantee of 20 plus years, more than 20 years. She thinks her longevity isn't 20 years.
So she could put it into something relatively safe.
Very
take
safe.
Out 5% per year and know that
right.
at least
spend
for
the principal
years.
And interest. You'll be spending principal and interest on the annuity as well. Mm-hmm. It's just that the annuity has a guarantee that if you run out of principal, they'll continue to pay you for the rest of your life. If you don't have a rest of your life, the guarantee wasn't worth anything.
Because you're paying for the guarantee.
You are paying for it one way or another. In a variable annuity, there's a direct fee. In an index annuity, there's either direct fee, usually close to 1% of whatever your interest is or whatever the principal is every year, or it's built into somewhere. There are some index annuity with these lifetime incomes that say, we don't charge a fee for our guarantee. Insurance companies don't do anything for free. If they're not charging you a specific overt fee, it's baked into what you're earning. And so if you were going to earn 4%, you're only going to earn 3. So they didn't charge you a fee. You still paid for it in earnings. Insurance companies don't guarantee anything for free. So it's baked into it one way or another.
So now in Sally's case, though, I mean, she doesn't think she's going to need it past 20 years. But you never know. But the decision at that point becomes yours. If I'm not going to make it past that, or I don't think I'm going to need anything past that, then there's no point in paying for it.
Right, and she can do similar issues by using and take into consideration that over the next 20 years, we may see higher interest rates than today's interest rates, and so she'll be able to earn more money on what's left over after even pulling some principal out of it, and she will still be able to. You know, even if she only earns 1 or 2%, maybe 3% over the lifetime of this principal, even pulling down the principal, it'll still last 22 years or more. So, I mean, the guarantee is almost it's so unless you have a long-term guarantee, a long-term life expectancy.
Yeah,
I just think the money is wasted paying the insurance company.
Yeah, because she could take advantage once interest rates go higher by not having it in the product. She could take some advantage of those higher interest rates.
And remember that fee that they say is 0.9%, 0.95, whatever it is, goes up as the cash value goes down. It's the same percentage, but the dollar amount as a percentage of the cash value will go up. We'll explain that later.
Yeah, keep that, write that down. That's an important thing to remember as well. Stuff that you're not going to hear anywhere else, folks. Okay, 877-PLANNER. Clem, give us a call back if you can. I know you got a question on IRA taxation. If not, we'll move Roger up after that in Fort Worth, Texas. 877-752-6637. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. Plum back fresh from the workshop last Saturday, and we welcome him back. It was a fun time. We'll tell you more about it maybe next hour, Professor, because I know you had a lot of questions from people there. Great questions, of course, in Las Vegas. And there will be more coming up this weekend. The Retirement Income Strategies workshops continue. We've got Seattle, Washington this weekend, Saturday, February 27th. And that'll be, 9 o'clock in the morning, local time start. If you need to sign up, if you want to sign up, you do need to sign up. But if you haven't done so yet, you go to wealth.com, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealthed.com. So this Saturday in Seattle, February 27th. Couple weeks after that, Phoenix AZ, you will be greeting and meeting the Brain Trust on March the 12th. And then we've added Portland, Oregon, of course, to Saturday morning, March 19th. So busy in February, busy in March, and all the way through into April. If you want to find out where else the Brain Trust will be, you go to that website, wealthed.com. Check out the live event schedule. Sign up there. It's all free. Learn all about retirement income strategies and challenges as well. WealthEd.com. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We still have some stuff to talk about on taxes, but we're going to continue on here with Roger in Fort Worth. Hello, Roger.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing today?
Oh, pretty good. I'm calling on my dad passed away in December, and I'm the executor of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out over the weekend what exactly he had in the bank. Everything he had within the confines of this bank, whether it be checking, savings, a small CD, but we found out, too, that he had an IRA.
Okay.
Approximately $8,000, and I'm wondering, I know taxes are going to have to come out of that IRA before it goes through the distribution to the heirs, but is there anything else? Is there going to be any kind of penalty or anything that I need to know about that IRA before I put it in the distribution process?
Well, the first thing you need to know about the IRA is who is the named beneficiary. Do you know that?
It didn't have one.
Oh, it didn't have one.
Okay. No, it just has the will that everything that he owns within the confines of his estate,
yeah,
is to be distributed among three heirs.
Okay, so at least it's not a huge issue. And you as the executor get to go through all the paperwork to be able to do it. You can cash it in, and then if you cash it in the same year that you distribute the money to the heirs, the taxation of that particular IRA will go to the heirs. So let's just make it $9,000 for ease of math. If it was $9,000 and you cash it in, the estate's got $9,000 of taxable income, but then the estate issues out all the money to the individual heirs, that $3,000 of taxable income to each heir, the $9,000 is split across the three heirs. And the heirs will be responsible for the taxes. You, as the executor, are responsible for filing his final tax return in 15, and then also for keeping track of what's happening in the estate, anything that happens after his passing, and then passing it on to the heirs. So you've got a little bit of work to do, but you're in charge. Luckily, or maybe not so luckily, it wasn't a huge IRA, and it's only $8,000, so the tax isn't going to be very, very much, but it'll be split between the heirs.
Okay. That's interesting that you asked me about, or you mentioned about filing the income tax. If he does happen to owe, is that going to be done just like the IRA? It'll be split three ways, and if he owes money, each of us have to...
Well, not necessarily. It will be, you need to do the income tax, and if he owes any income tax, if he hasn't withheld enough through the year, then the estate pays the tax before it passes on the money to the heirs. So if dad owes, you know, a couple $1,000, you write a checker from the estate assets, the bank accounts, to cover all his final expenses. Taxes are one of his final expenses. Anything else, whatever that's you're responsible for because of his passing, you as the executor free up all that, you clear everything, and then what's left over you get to pass on to the heirs. So don't start just distributing all the cash to the heirs until you know that you've covered all the expenses, because Unfortunately, as the executor, I've seen this happen where they just, okay, there's $100,000 in the bank account, four heirs, everybody gets 25 grand, and then they get a bill for something, and they're like, well, hey, all you other three heirs, I need some of that money back. They're like, not a chance. You deal with it, because you were supposed to clear it before you sent the money. So hold on to the money, clear the estate, then pass on the assets.
How long generally should I hold on to the estate before I do any distribution and make sure all the creditors have made their...
Well, the first thing is I would call any credit cards and say, hey, so-and-so passed away, and usually they'll just write off that bill at that point. Doctor's bills and other things are other issues, so those should you should have a pretty good idea of it. It depends on how complex and you know, what Dad was doing. He sounds like he kept everything fairly simple, fairly straightforward, so it's you just have to take it for a reasonable time, several, a couple of months. You're not going to have to take it for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And just let the dust settle before you and pay off what he's responsible for paying. Don't pay what he's not responsible for paying, and then pass the assets down. But make sure you file his final return, too.
Okay, I'll do it. I appreciate your time.
No problem, Roger.
Thank you, Roger, for the call. He asked some great questions. That's another topic that we'll have coming up within the next week or two, which has to do with estate planning and taxes and all that kind of stuff. Things that the heirs need to be aware of. Now, his father did not have a
didn't have a trust or anything.
Yeah. So, but it seems.
But he did have a will.
He had a will of heirs, I guess, or three people that the money's going to be split up.
So Roger has been named probably, I guess, what happened. And, he's been named the executor, so he's going to be the one that files all the court paperwork to take this through whatever probate is required in the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming Dad lived in Texas as well, or the state of his residence, wherever that may have been. And so he's got certain things to follow up on.
Now, the fact that he passed away in December of 2015 means that he's got through the rest of this year to take care of a lot of stuff, right?
Well, he's got as much time as he needs, but I'm sure that this doesn't sound like a complicated estate. It's not going to take that long.
No.
And shows that there is an importance to putting a named beneficiary on IRAs in all types of retirement accounts because
cuts down on the probate costs.
It's well, not just that; it cuts down on the work that the executor has to deal with. Luckily, this was not a huge IRA. I mean, imagine if it had been $800,000. Then Roger was going to have to jump through a lot of hoops to be able to split it up the right way. But you can still do it. It's just work. Work that can be avoided by just naming beneficiaries. So every time you go through a review, every year, check your beneficiaries. Make sure they're who you want to be, but make sure there's beneficiaries there, contingent beneficiaries as well.
For sure, 877 Planner, good advice. Let's move along. Daniel is up next in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Daniel.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. Both my spouse and I are both 52, and we hope to retire at 50. And in keeping with some of your suggestions previously, I had moved I intend to work between now 52 and 60. And for the money between 60 and 70, I had done some calculations that you guys had suggested and come up with the figure that I need about $600,000 for the years between 60 and 70. And so I had moved the first 4 years of that. I guess I should preface this. I'm sorry. I was saying the vast majority of our retirement savings is in the TSP, the federal government plan. So I had moved the first 4 years of that amount into the 2020 plan, and the remaining 6 years into the 2030 plan. And so when I took a look at those after making the moves, I'm not sure how comfortable I am with how much of it's still allocated to equities that could fluctuate a great deal. I don't have a whole lot of as far as...
Now, you've got five basic choices.
Okay.
You're in the Thrift Savings Plan, the federal government's 401k for all intents and purposes. And they have basically five choices. And they have these lifestyle funds or life cycle funds as well. But all the life cycle funds are combinations of the five other choices. So you either want to manage it yourself or you let them do it. I would probably pull back the aggressiveness on the 20 and make it maybe the 2010. I'd even use the G fund for a little bit of it and use the 2015 and the 2020 where you're using the 2020. The 2030 is probably almost half stocks at this point.
And, it is. It's 65% stock.
Yeah, which isn't.
I mean, I owe you the 2020 is 45%, and the 2030 is 65%.
Right. The 2020, I fine for that second time period that you're looking at, because it's basically 10 years from now. And I don't have a problem with a 45% allocation there. So I'd back down like one or two notches on the life cycles on those, or for the first bucket. And as you get closer to the year age 60, into more of that first bucket, into the G fund is going to make a lot of sense. So on the pops, where the market's higher than expected, where the account's higher than expected, you put it into the G fund. Now, your new contributions, the money that you're putting in out of every paycheck, should not be in either one of these funds.
I've heard you say that in the past, and I'm allocated all new money to more aggressive funding.
I would either use, what's the longest they've got, a 2055?
There's a 2050 that's currently
2050.
Available.
So I would either use the 2050, or I'd just go straight to the CS&I funds and use those three funds.
Actually, that's what I'm doing with new allocations.
Good.
I'm doing like 60, 30, 20, or whatever.
Yeah, pull down the aggressiveness on the, you know, go 2020 to 2015 and 2030 to 2020. You'll be fine.
Daniel, you're doing it just right. Great job. If you have some more questions, hold on.
And we'll be in Portland on the 12th.
That's
come by
right.
And see us.
That's right. Come on by.
The 19th?
Well, hold on. Told you in a second.
Dang it.
Bucket Strategy Investing continues. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. Another hour is just ahead, so stay tuned for more of this. More of your emails, too, coming up. In fact, we've had in our discussion today, Professor Plum, we've been talking about real estate investment trusts. We've been talking a little bit about Social Security. Let's see. We had 403B, taxes, wills, thrift savings plans, all this stuff. And among all this, we've been getting some emails various topics. So I want to get to at least one or two that have come in within the last 15, 20 minutes or so. This one is from Fred in Whitehall, PA. I have two closed-end mutual funds listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Both have a net asset value over the current listed price. Now, Fred wants to know, what are the pros and cons of this? Explain what we're talking about
here. Well, it sounds like what he's telling me is that the closed-end fund is selling at a premium. So if you looked at the underlying investments and added up the price of those, and then looked at the price that the actual closed-end fund is selling for, it's higher than just adding up the stocks. If I had 10 stocks all at 10 bucks a share, that'd be $100, and it's like the net asset value is at 105. So it's selling at a premium. So for whatever reason, the market likes the way that these have been put together and is higher premium for it. Why? That I couldn't tell you why. So, but most of the time, a closed-end fund is going to trade somewhat near, you know, the net asset value. It's going to have a little bit of a premium, a little bit of a discount, depending upon people's perception of that grouping of stocks. And so, without knowing more about the individual underlying securities, I have no idea why it's selling at a premium or why it may have been selling for a discount at another time. And that's where a stock analyst really gets involved. That's where somebody who spends their time, you know, looking at all this type of stuff, not talking about taxes, not talking about Social Security, not talking about estate planning and things of that nature, is really an invaluable tool. So having a CFA or somebody understanding and looking at this stuff makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, have some specialization. I mean, there's some people that have that. These are the people that you want to turn to on that in that
or having
regard.
Access to them.
Access.
They may
to
not
them.
Talk to you, but if you know they're working for you, it's still it
hey,
still
it's
helps.
Like our it's like our brain trust, the access that we've got to just about everybody. Sure.
And I could go talk to some of our CFAs and talk to them about how that works, but I don't have the time at the moment. We only have a 1 minute.
Invite them on the show. They're just nerdy, kind of, you know what I mean? They're just not all that interesting.
They're very people. Interesting if you can speak their language.
Well, that's part of it. It's
they just
speak.
I mean, you think we speak a different language? Wow. Talk to a CFA.
877-WealthEd.com plus our website, WealthEd.com. We have another one, Cynthia in New Jersey. My question is regarding Roth contributions and one of our future income scenarios. At age 65, we will start my husband's pensions. Along with this income, we will have other cash savings and non-taxable income, like government bonds. And then she says, with this in mind, if we start taking 401k and traditional IRA distributions at my husband's full retirement age, and my husband suspends his Social Security, are we able to continue putting money into a Roth until his age 70? Thank you and for your advice and great work. So,
well, I mean, I'm not sure where the suspension of Social Security comes in, other than the fact that you're not going to be taking it, which means it's not going to be a potential taxable event. And when you say putting money into a Roth, will you be able to convert? Yes, you'll be able to convert. Will you be able to contribute? I didn't hear anything about earned income in there. Sounds like you're retiring at that point. So the only way to put new money, new contributions into a Roth is to have earned income. Now, if you don't have earned income and you are looking at your tax bracket and you're saying, you know what, I have room in my current tax bracket that I may not have later on when I start my Social Security, when I start my required minimum distributions, now may be a great time from 65, if you're retiring at 65 to 70, to do some Roth conversions. And yes, you can at any time, other than one aspect of things. You cannot convert the required minimum distribution. That has to come out and stay out. But you're not at 70 years old yet, 70 and a half. So you can do conversions, and it may be a great strategy while you're taking the lower amount of income that you need in the early years before Social Security kicks in and before your required minimum distributions kick in, doing some conversions from 65 to 70, which reduces the IRA, which reduces the ultimate required minimum distribution, which may actually help you with the taxation on Social Security. I don't know that for a fact. But no, I think it makes a lot of sense in a lot of cases to do some Roth conversions during those years where you're not working and you're not getting your Social Security yet.
Now, where would it not make sense? Where you're up against a tax bracket where any new money is going to push you up into a higher one or what?
Well, I mean, because of the Social Security, I have a feeling it's going to make sense to do it. But yeah, I've seen it where people will do conversions where they have like $5,000 or $10,000 of room in their tax bracket, going back to what we started this hour talking about, understanding tax brackets. But their required minimum distribution would have been in the same bracket anyway. And so they push it into today and they pay more. Maybe they do a $40,000 or $50,000 conversion. They try to get it done over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then
putting it all at the same.
Yeah, you know, they've got a $100,000 IRA, $200,000 IRA. They're 65 years old. So they do 40, 40, 40, 40, 40, 5 40s, and they get converted all over. But that $40,000 distribution conversion takes them out of the 15 and puts them in the 25% bracket, where the required minimum distribution of $8,000 to $10,000 would have stayed in the 15% bracket anyway. So they paid 25
when
on money that they would have otherwise paid 20 or 15 on. That's not the right way to do it necessarily. But I mean, we have to just know the tax brackets and look forward. In their case, because they're going to postpone taking Social Security, which I'm presuming means that the Social Security will be a nice number ultimately at 70, I think it probably does make sense to do the conversions before you take the Social Security.
Yeah, and again, on contributions, you have to have earned income. So things like distributions from IRAs or 401ks or whatever does not count toward that particular.
So contributions, if you're not working, out. Conversions may be the right thing to do.
Okay, well, I hope that helps you out, Cynthia. If you have any more details, you can certainly email us with those. We've got a couple more emails, William, and a few others. We're going to start actually next hour with those. I also want to get into some of the stuff they talked about on the at the workshop last Saturday. A lot of stuff to talk about. If you need the Brain Trust off the air, you can talk to them at Lucia Capital Group at their off-air number. 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. I want to remind you, too, that there is another series of workshops coming up here in the date. I just wanted to correct this.
Yeah, and I said the wrong date.
You said the wrong date. That's right, but that's okay. Seattle happens this Saturday. So if you're in the Seattle area, stop on by, see the workshop at, where is it? I didn't get a location.
Seattle's the Hilton, SeaTac.
Okay, SeaTac. So you've been there many times before. Seattle this Saturday, February 27th. March 12th, Phoenix, Arizona. That's a couple of weeks away. And then the 19th is when they're going to be in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
You had said the
12th. I was a week early.
That's right. So if you're watching or listening in Phoenix, that's 12th. The 12th. Portland is going to be on the 19th.
Yes.
We got that squared away. Okay, another hour is just ahead. Johnny Dean and Professor Rick Plum, we will take some more of your phone calls. We will take some more of your emails. We did not get to all the emails, but hey, we'll try to do as best we can next hour. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Don't go away.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.